Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Adulski, with my co-host, Dr. Carl. We got our favorite fellow Docs Who Lift here, back for maybe their third time or so.
Another crossover episode. Third,
but not last. We got Dr. Austin Baraki, who recently joined my team at Vineyard. And we have Dr. Jordan Vagenbaum, who both are part of the Barbell Medicine crew. Today, we're going to be talking about peptides. What the hell they are and what they do and what is the data behind them. So welcome to the podcast, because everybody's asking about this. I think you guys did a podcast about this, and we troll people online and whatever. So anyway, welcome. We're going to chat it up.
Thanks, guys. It is amazing to see the discourse around these things and these like lists on threads and things like that of all the things people are injecting into their bodies while simultaneously having a lot of skepticism about injecting other things into their bodies.
Yeah, exactly. Let's start it off. What are peptides in just a very basic sense, by the way, like basic biochemistry, early medical school? What are peptides?
Yeah. I think this is actually a pretty interesting thing when you see it discussed online. So peptides, people will say, oh, they're just these short chains of amino acids, which is true from a pure chemistry standpoint. But when you're talking about something that's not a food, not a dietary supplement, has a therapeutic intent, right? That means it's a medication. You could call it a drug, a medication, whatever, neutral terms. So a peptide drug, by definition, is one whose chemical composition is made up of amino acids. And if you really want to go into the weeds, there's been some kind of lines in the sand drawn about how long these chains of amino acids can be before it's categorized as a peptide or a biologic, a longer chain of amino acids, which we call a protein. And in 2020, the FDA just arbitrarily decided 40 amino acids long. That's it. And so things like semaglutide, tirzepatide, the GLP-1s generally are considered peptide drugs. When you say GLP-1, the P is peptide. But something like insulin, which is over 50 amino acids, is technically a biologic, although any clinician is like, well, really, it's a peptide, you know, whatever. It's just all it was a line in the sand about how these things are made and how to classify them. And then there are other agents that are kind of lumped into the peptide drug or peptide medication class that are really small molecule drugs. And the only reason that these things matter are for really bioavailability. Like small molecule drugs like MK677, it's a growth hormone promoting agent. It doesn't really work, not FDA approved, but it's small molecule, so it is orally available, right? Same thing like aspirin, statins, et cetera. A peptide drug like semaglutide, GLP-1s, or BPC-157, or something like that, generally you have to inject, and biologics are more complicated and even longer, and also generally have to be injected. And so when you see like oral peptides, generally you can think that they're probably bogus, save for like Rybelsus, you know, the oral version of semaglutide. Although they spent millions, if not billions of dollars to figure out how to make that orally available. So the whole point is this. If you're on Amazon and you're buying BPC-157 and you're like, oh, this is a peptide drug. Well, it would be a peptide drug except for it's not orally available because it usually requires an injection due to the chemical structure, which is that short chain of amino acids. So that's my, Austin, you're the chemist on the call. Any?
Yeah, my answer would have been way simpler as a result of that. You went into a lot more depth. So yeah, props to you.
Yeah, right. So a little background, because a lot of the people online go, oh, these other peptides, other than the actual drugs and medications that we have approved, they say, well, you know, because they're natural and all this stuff. And, you know, we do have endogenous peptides, a ton of them. In fact, I looked up, it said I found over 7,000 different and naturally occurring endogenous peptides in our bodies. Generally, they are hormones, so most of them get into my world that have been cataloged. And so people think that that's, you know, for some reason makes them safe. But all these peptides that they're talking about buying and injecting are drugs, like you just said. They are drugs that are synthesized to achieve a desired, allegedly, biological effect, and thus have potential benefits, potential safety issues, dosing things, all that need to be studied, right?
Yeah, it doesn't really need to be such a siloed sort of classification. I mean, if you look at even among the peptide hormones that you described there that are endogenously created, let's say that we take insulin as an example of those that synthesized, that can still kill you very easily just because it is quote unquote natural. People can kill themselves with insulin as a result of its very potent biological action and its impact on blood sugar levels and things like that. And so the argument that it is natural is not really relevant here. I think that fundamentally there should just be a basic standard of evidence that we look for of, hey, I'm going to put something in my body. There's a certain standard of evidence. And first we should establish safety. And then I think subsequent to that, we should establish efficacy. And that's fortunately how, you know, clinical trial are structured in terms of like the phases and things like that over the longer period of time. The unfortunate thing here is, you know, we have very little evidence on safety. We have very little evidence on efficacy. And rather than interrogate that further and say, maybe we should aim to have some of that evidence before broadly and potentially even aggressively marketing and recommending these things, people just weave conspiracy narratives around this sort of thing. And I know that Jordan has gotten a lot more into the weeds on those conspiracy narratives and looked at like, where are people coming from? What are the claims around it? But you know, all of us probably have been accused of like, we are either protecting our own egos or our own profits or something like that. And it's like, look, if we just had evidence that this stuff worked and that it was safe, I would happily use it because some of the claims, for example, around, you know, some of these things for injury recovery or like rehealing tendons, I would have used that stuff because I've had so many issues with tendinopathy over the years myself. I would 100% just like, show me that it works and it is safe. You know, the evidence for GLP-1s, for example, didn't used to exist, and then it existed, and now we use those medicines comfortably, confidently, on a regular basis. And so there is just a certain standard that we look for, and instead we see people allow there being a certain standard for, you know, FDA-approved pharmaceutical interventions and, like, carving out exceptions that are, like, back-rationalized for these other sorts of molecules and supported by all sorts of conspiracy narratives of the pharmaceutical companies want to keep this secret or whatever other kind of things that, again, Jordan is more familiar with from arguing with people on Threads.
So because God forbid if they found out that they were beneficial and safe, they'd sell the hell out of them.
So, yeah. Okay. So to summarize, peptides, umbrella term, short chain amino acids put together that then have in what people term as peptides, because peptides could be anything, even stuff that we ingest that have other functions, but these are essentially drug-like effects from these peptide of these chains of amino acids, and with varying different types of effects in our body. And so then let's get into how did these get so popular. I have my theories. I believe it is mostly from the GLP-1 receptor agonist becoming so popular on social media. And then, but not only that, because of the compounded nature of these medicines, basically when they went into shortage, they were allowed to be compounded. And then people are going, wait, if these things work, what the hell else is out there? And then they just started going off. It was like a gateway drug. And so
talk about, you know, conflicts of interest. It's just because people found a way to sell a bunch of BS. And I just, you know, I posted that thing on Facebook from the science-based medicine crowd about how they're kind of the new snake oil. And tons of people came out of the woodwork just, you know, making all sorts of false analogies and fallacies and all sorts of stuff because they just think that their anecdotes are okay and that they don't understand that these are drugs.
So,
and, you know, and we have 100 peptide-based drugs that have been approved by the FDA, and people don't trust the FDA either. I mean, I get that.
Right.
But there's huge mountains of evidence for these drugs. And again, like you said, in my world of endocrinology, I mean, we have insulin. In OBGYN, they use oxytocin. In my world, we have a lot of replacement therapies like vasopressin for what we call diabetes insipidus or vasopressin deficiency now. And we have medications that are like parathyroid analogs for osteoporosis. We have actual parathyroid hormone now, palopeg teriparatide for hypoparathyroidism, and just so many more, like you said, GLP-1 receptor agonists and growth hormone and growth hormone releasing hormones that people are taking inappropriately now. And it's just unreal to me that these all required extraordinary amounts of data to show that they're safe and effective in humans. And so we know what the doses are and how to use them. So yeah, it blows my mind that this happened.
Do you have theories, Jordan, or Austin, about why it became so popular?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, because all of these peptide drugs, again, we accept that they're a medication and they're a drug just based on definitions. Okay. All of them come from big pharma. Big pharma collectively has identified these agents and subsequently tested them to varying degrees. Obviously, there are many different agents here. So varying degrees of testing have happened, but they're all developed by big pharma. So that you got to say their medications developed by big pharma. And then you have to also say that they are not natural. While they may naturally occur either in the human body or in nature, they have been synthesized and so therefore are synthetic. And so, you know, when people are like, oh, well, they're natural, well, they occur naturally, but like the insulin, for example, you get, or the GLP-1 you get, nobody took a bunch of Gila monsters and squeezed out the semaglutide, you know, it's all been made in a lab. So you establish that baseline, right? These things, insulin was created in 1920, oxytocin, vasopressin in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And then you fast forward to GLP-1s, 90s, BPC-157, 1990s, right? So these have been around for a while in varying degrees. However, I think you're right, Spencer, that with GLP-1s becoming much more popular, people are having like normalized not only the use of just peptides, period, but also injecting themselves with medications, right? And further, there's less barrier to entry than like anabolic steroids. Anabolic steroids, generally speaking, you can't, you know, buy online from like a research, you know, for research chemicals. You can buy, you know, aromatase inhibitors, you can buy SARMs, you know, all sorts of stuff. But like if you wanted to get testosterone, usually there are more barriers there. Or you got to know, you know, Vinny down at Gold's Gym, no hate comes to Gold's Gym, and he's going to hook you up. Here, you could buy CJC-1295, you know, to promote growth hormone release. You could buy ivermorelin, MK-677, BPC-15, all these different agents because they're not made for human use. So there's a legal loophole. So they're easier to get, right? There's less obstacles and this normalization around using injectable medications. So to me, the way I describe them is like, these are just anabolic steroids that, you know, studied abroad. They appear to be a little are perceived to be a little bit more refined. But when you kind of drill down on each individual agent and you look at what evidence do we have for them, what evidence do we have that they do the things that are claimed, most of these things tend to fall apart. Most of them have been abandoned by big pharma. And to Carl's point earlier, if they worked, then pharma would want to get their ROI here, right? Like a BPC-157 is easily, I made a post that said there's no human randomized controlled trial data in BPC-157, which happens to be true. But that has been by far my most popular post, and popular is doing a lot of heavy lifting there because most of the comments were not positive. People are like, you don't know what you're talking about. Here's a big pharma. I'm like, So this drug was actually identified by a pharmaceutical company called Pliva, which has subsequently been sold and acquired two different times. They've patented it because people say, oh, you can't patent it because it's a naturally occurring, you know, agent. I'm like, well, yeah, but if you can patent the synthetic manufacture of that, the protocol for how to do that. Also, the FDA offers protections if you bring it to market first. So this is not really the limiting factor, even though it is patentable. Ironically, none of these people are patent law experts. I'm not either, but I'm just like, that's probably not the thing here. And further, they've tried, for example, and started three human randomized controlled clinical trials in BPC-157. All of them terminated early and none of the results published, which I'm not saying makes it completely dangerous or ineffective, but it certainly is a red flag. And I think if you looked at that on balance, if there was like a vaccine, for example, that had that sort of track record, people would be very skeptical of it. But with BPC-157, the marketing around this stuff is like, well, they're natural. Your body makes them anyway. They're just short chain amino acids. So what's the harm compared to like an anabolic steroid where people are like, well, that's different. I'm like, it's also naturally occurring. It's just a different chemical structure. And so like perhaps like relatively low, maybe is, I don't want to say scientific literacy, but maybe like chemistry literacy. And then this sort of normalization of injecting medicines. I think all of that plus the access has really, really done a number, and you know, maybe marketing too on top of it.
Are there any of these things that actually do have evidence other than the GLP-1? We know those are FDA approved. We know Tesamorelin is also FDA approved. We can get into that. But like, what are any of these other popular ones?
Just say, because everyone who's going to listen to this, or at least the people who are the skeptics of what we're trying to say, they don't trust the FDA.
No,
so,
like,
what I'm trying to say, it doesn't matter if the FDA approves them. We're just talking about the evidence.
What has randomized controlled trial data? And if you can explain why, and we'll get into why you really do need randomized controlled trial data. This is just a basic understanding of why we need these trials and why. Yeah. Basic understanding of science.
Yeah, I don't think any of us are going to like defend the FDA as being like, look, you've always done it right, you've always gotten it right. But I do think it's important to say like why FDA approval is something that we would seek as like a bare minimum for use. Like, you wouldn't want the FDA to have no input on safety and efficacy of medications. You think back to like, what is it, Elixir sulfanilamide, the sulfa drug craze that killed like hundreds of people because they had what's now in radiator fluid mixed in there and they never tested it. Those in the 30s. On the other hand, you wouldn't want such strict regulation that no experimental drugs can be used in various cases. You think about like the HIV AIDS when that started. So you want some sort of flexibility around like, look, we have some evidence of like safety and efficacy, but you don't need like ironclad stuff just to get it approved. You just want some sort of minimum sort of data set, like how does the drug work? What does it interact with, perhaps? What to monitor? Like just bare minimum stuff. As far as stuff we have evidence on, a surprising number of them we do have like phase one, phase two clinical trial stuff on, but most of them just don't work, which is why they were abandoned. So, for example, CJC-1295, right, Conjicam came up with this. It's a growth hormone promoting agent. The trial was shut down early because there was one guy who had a heart attack. Now, whether this caused his heart attack, unclear. Some people say, oh, you can't do this. It's just a growth hormone promoting agent. There's no signal there. And I draw your attention then to MK-677, which is a small molecule drug that also is a growth hormone promoting agent that actually does have a congestive heart failure, a sort of risk associated with it. And that's one of the monitoring protocols are actually studying this now in pediatric growth hormone deficiency to be an oral option instead of using recombinant growth hormone. So there's some evidence, but not really good evidence. You think about tesamorelin, ipamorelin, some of these other ones that have data that they'll reduce visceral fat. Well, that's true, but less than like a GLP-1, for example, which is interesting, right? And BPC-157 has no evidence in humans that's randomized and controlled. The extent of that data is there was a clinic that basically called up patients that they had prescribed BPC-157 for, I think 14 of them. They called them on the phone and said, hey, we prescribed it to you. Like, your knees feel better? And they're like, most of them said, yeah. So I'm like, okay, that's the extent of the data. And then a two-person pharmacokinetic study, which is insufficient. The irony or maybe interesting thing about BPC-157 is almost 90%, perhaps even more, of all the data from BPC-157, experimental data, is from the same research group who discovered the agent. And it's mostly in Petri dish stuff and rodent or animal models, rather. So not in humans, which, again, isn't like a death sentence, but you would think you would want more stuff in humans. TB-500, often paired with BPC-157, has some data on wound healing when topically applied, but nothing when it's injected. But its build is like, oh, it heals your muscles and tendons. And it's like, big if true, that would be a huge market to tap into, but there's not evidence there. But those are all older agents, right? Stuff from like the 90s and 2000s. Newer stuff, MOTS-C, for example, retatrutide. More evidence is emerging on retatrutide, but MOTS-C is so new, it has never even been tested in humans. So and like
tons of people are taking this. Tons of 100%. People.
What is the proposed biological plausibility that would normally just lead to animal studies and then phase one human trials and then phase two and then phase three that we do have with retatrutide, even though they're not getting the real stuff out there yet?
The weirdest thing about this is like I call them zombie drugs, right? These are things that have been abandoned by pharma, like AOD was anti-obesity drug 9604. This was like from a group in Australia. They have done phase one, phase two, phase three clinical trials in humans, right, for obesity, and it didn't work. And now, so pharma abandoned. They're like, well, look, it doesn't work. So we got to move on to our next agent, you know, try to get our ROI here. But people are like, no, this is a great fat loss medication. It's like, if true, again, pharma, even if it worked like relatively poorly, but still worked, it would have made it to market because at the time that predates, you know, using semaglutide, using tirzepatide, GLP-1s for weight loss. or like melanotan 2, right? This is like an injectable drug that makes people real, real tan and gives them like really long lasting erections, but also causes like rhabdomyolysis and, you know, severe kidney injury in a lot of people. It's like, this has been studied. Like, we know this, yet people are like, nah, that's fine. Because again, these are just short chain amino acids.
Yeah, one of the things, one of the,
I remember when Spencer was in his 20s and he wanted to take that to get tan and have erections too, but
well, I'm pretty sure Jordan took it before. Look at how tan he is.
And they were right, man. It's no San Diego. Well, but like PT-141, bromelanotide is, I think it's Viseli, is now an FDA approved drug for hypoactive sexual desire disorder, particularly in women, and has been studied in men off label for those who are, you know, resistant to PDE5 inhibitors like Cialis, Viagra, etc. So, like, we're not saying that peptide drugs as a whole are bad. It is just that, like any other medication, any other therapeutic, you'd want to know what are the risks, what are the benefits, you know, proposed mechanisms, and then you can try to make what we call informed consent. But if you have no human evidence, or all of the human evidence to date is negative or suggests a pretty strong risk signal, especially if there are other therapeutics that are available, then that seems like a poor, you know, sort of strategy, a poor decision-making tool to use these things.
Austin, I want to hear Austin explain, why do we need randomized controlled trials? This is like basic stuff. Why people don't even know the difference between a randomized controlled trial and an opinion paper. Can you explain?
Or even back up a little bit more. Why are human clinical trials essential?
This is kind of
efficacy, safety, dosing, long-term effects in the rodents. Who cares?
Yeah, this is the big point that I wanted to make. Again, somebody earlier mentioned that they were like speaking to the skeptics in the audience of people who maybe are listening to this, rage listening to us talk about this, and maybe getting the sense that, for example, we are absolute rigid, like we will only ever prescribe certain drugs in the, you know, optimal ideal context with like maximum perfect evidence and only in line with like the labeling practice and all that sort of thing. And I think there is a spectrum of, you know, practice that you will encounter. Some people who are definitely very like aggressive, rigid, I will only do what's in clinical practice guidelines and nothing else. And I think that there is a role for that. Mainly like as somebody who trains, you know, interns and residents and medical students, like I want them to like learn those guidelines first, like learn how to do things in that vein before you learn to like kind of color outside the lines a little bit. And then as you gain more time in practice, more experience in practice, more comfort with the medicines, with the physiology or the pathophysiology of the person in front of you, then you can gain a little bit of comfort and confidence again with the backstop of knowing that like, this is a reasonable and safe thing to do in this situation. Maybe 9 out of 10 doctors, 99 out of 100 doctors who looked at what I'm doing, even though this might not be perfectly in line with like the official FDA labeling, they'd be like, yeah, that's probably reasonable. And I think it's safe, right? We all do this all the time. Awesome.
A lot of that's, you know, be also like how to interpret the data that you're about to talk about, why it's so important.
Yes, exactly. Right.
That experience.
Yeah. So the reason I mention this is, again, if we had that knowledge, that background understanding, even if we didn't have like the pinnacle of evidence for these peptide things, if we had that background understanding of like, I feel super confident that this is safe, it has a very well characterized mechanism, and then maybe I'm willing, even if I don't have ideal evidence, I might, you know, feel comfortable, feel safe trying something, even if it is not, again, perfectly in line with the precise way that it was studied. So ultimately, there's like a spectrum of standards that people can like look for when it comes to using things in practice. And all we are kind of advocating for here, I think, is like have a standard and articulate it. Because one of the challenges is for people who are proponents of MOTC, to the one I'm he knows more about some of these like, you know, fresh peptide takes than I am, but if you ask somebody like, can you articulate what would be the standard that you would look for to make you feel comfortable, like widely recommending that people use this? And for some of the proponents, especially, you know, be it on social media where there's like no stakes to them saying anything because nobody's going to come and like sue them for advocating for something online, they might say, nah, I mean, like I've seen a bunch of people feel better when they use it. And that's their standard, right? And that is now getting to the point that we are trying to make here, is that is insufficient as a standard, because you could think back to, you know, it was funny. I was at like a group gathering recently, and somehow somebody started having hiccups. And then very amusingly, every other person in the group started to talk about their like family's hiccup cure. And it was obviously the most preposterous stuff. And it was like this perfect example of like this, each person is like, oh, I learned you have to like hold your breath for this many seconds. I learned you have to like drink this many gulps of this type of fluid. And it's just like a perfect encapsulation of like, I've seen this work, so it works. And I think all of us know that that is unlikely to be the case for so many different things, with low biological plausibility for why something like that would work. Hiccups have a natural history. They tend to get better on their own with time, probably regardless of what silly things you do or don't do in between. And so those are the types of things that well-designed research helps us to tease out. How much is this intervention modifying that natural history that we're looking for? Is this like a common cold? There are zillions of common cold cures, right? When you are feeling at your worst, literally do anything you want. And it is likely that over the course of the next few days to the next week, you're going to get better on your own. So that is where somebody who doesn't have this sort of mindset would look at that and say, well, they felt bad. They did the thing. They got better. Simple cause-effect linear relationship. This is why designing studies to help us eliminate that source of bias is most useful. Also, we can look at comparing, especially when we do trials in humans, the types of, you know, subjects that we're proposing treating with these things. We can compare, how do they do receiving this peptide versus a sham version or a placebo? This is super useful, not just to tell how much better is this working compared with placebo or the natural history, but side effects. Are they actually happening more often? This came up probably most saliently in the realm of statin research, when people have done, you know, statin versus placebo research, and we see, oh, like almost 90% of the side effects that people were reporting from taking a statin, they were also reporting when they take a placebo drug. The only, you know, side effect free state is when they stopped taking any type of pill altogether. So humans, we are pattern recognition machines. When we see somebody who's experiencing something, then do something, and then they feel a certain way afterwards, we're going to tie those things together in a causal chain, because probably from, I don't know, some evolutionary standpoint, that heuristic maybe worked in our favor more often than it didn't. But when it comes to injecting synthetic substances from, you know, whatever bathtub it was made in into your body and hoping for an effect, yeah, like I wouldn't be surprised. You know, I often cite in like placebo conversations, go back to Space Jam, watch what happened when they drank Mike's secret stuff. You know, they started playing out of their minds. If you inject something that you have a strong belief in that has some fancy code name, you know, term to it, and somebody that you trust, whether the FDA or whether Joe Rogan recommended it, you're going to have a high baseline expectation of this thing working. You're very likely to feel better. If it were me and I'm spending my money, my time, and injecting myself with something, I would prefer to know that it's more likely that it is helping me than this is a long placebo effect that I'm giving myself. Other people's standard might be different. They might say, I don't care if it's placebo, I'm willing to do it anyway. It's like, okay, as long as you're going into that with eyes wide open, but you have a standard. And that's what I don't think we see articulated very often in this space, is what is the standard that you are looking for to recommend this, broadly speaking? For us, it is ideally having some form of randomized trial controlled with placebo in humans. It doesn't have to be FDA approval. It doesn't have to be some of these other things, but that is our standard, to at least to look at another human and say, I'm going to do this to you. I would like for it to have been done to somebody before in a way that allows me to say, okay, this is more likely to help you than it is to harm you for your particular situation.
Perfect. I want to get all of your takes on this, not to commandeer, but like, do you think that floor, we'll call it, of evidence or, changes based on the stakes? So let me give you, like, to my mind, the two different ends of this, right? One end is you have what otherwise would be a terminal condition that there are no therapeutics for right now. And so this experimental agent is available. We don't really know what it does, what it works, but, like, you know, that's one situation. Is that different? Your need for evidence, or floor, we'll call it, minimum barrier entry for evidence. Is that different than, like, maybe health optimization on the other hand, somebody who's otherwise doing fine and they're just looking to take that next step, right? They're like, well, this is living better through chemistry. I'm not actually treating anything, any deficiency or any, you know, certainly nothing terminal. I just want to have a better experience. Do you think the stakes change your sort of evidence level that you need?
Yeah, and I think that plays out in actual research in medicine for, you know, the difference between, say, oncology, right? Where, like you said, you have, you know, people get put into these trials all the time because they're going to die. And so, you know, it's a little bit more benefit to risk ratio compared to just taking something when you're really, really healthy, that if you don't know what it is, I mean, there's a lot more risk with potentially no benefit. I mean, to me, that's kind of crazy. So I think that's absolutely appropriate. And
on the other hand, whenever I pull up I make analogies, I make these very sarcastic, facetious analogies on Threads, if anybody wants to go check them out. But basically, contrasting like the phase 3 robust data we have from the COVID vaccine versus peptides that have no human data at all, other than maybe a retrospective survey that where they called people. And someone made the good point. It's like, well, people don't really care about protecting themselves from some disease that they may or may not get, but give them a chance to actually potentially improve themselves without human data. They're jumping at it. And it's extremely true. We're seeing it right now.
Like, that's amazing. Yeah. And, you know, and our thing is, you know, we're supposed to say, you know, do no harm first. Right. And to that point, you know, what you guys were just talking about, literally on that post, I was saying right before we got on, I saw one person comment because I said, anecdotes don't, you know, we're trying to explain why anecdotes don't matter. He said, well, you would think once you have hundreds and thousands of anecdotes, that would be good enough evidence. And I'm like, that's why we do randomized controlled trials, because of the regression to the mean that you were just describing. And it's one of my favorite columns that we should probably share with us.
There was a lot of anecdotes around fen-phen. For example, turned out that when rigorously studied, they were like, oh, actually, there's this like crazy heart disease data.
Yeah, there's precedent for this. And Austin Jordan, Casey, you may know this a little bit better, but antiarrhythmia drugs where they thought like, oh, yeah, like, obviously we should just use these. Thalidomide, all sorts of things. They've done this in the past where it seemed like this would be a good idea. Then they tested it and it's like, oh God, this was actually harming.
Right.
This has happened so many times throughout the centuries of medicine. Is the concept of biological plausibility is itself a messy one, because it entirely depends on like your understanding of the biology being accurate, right? And so through a certain lens, something might seem biologically plausible that it is likely to work. And that you made a couple of good examples of, like, you know, suppressing arrhythmias. You're like, oh yeah, if your rhythm is abnormal, it would seem biologically plausible that suppressing it would be helpful. And then they ran the CAST trial in the 90s and like, oh, when we suppress these arrhythmias, people die way more often, right? Or other forms of biological plausibility where you think something would be harmful, but it ends up being beneficial. So classic example of this would be in patients with heart failure. They'd be like, well, you know, of course you should never put a patient with heart failure on a beta blocker because you don't want to suppress their contractility. And other thing, and then it's like, oh, beta blockers are now absolute class one standard of care for patients with, you know, certain forms of heart failure because it actually benefited them because our understanding of the biology was incomplete. So unless you have this like omniscient knowledge of biology, then you cannot rely on just bioplausibility alone. You definitely shouldn't rely on anecdote alone. The only way to prevent ourselves from fooling ourselves in these situations is with these types of clever trial designs that we do, right? That's how we can avoid fooling ourselves, deluding ourselves based on some of these common patterns that people can fall into. So just again, I cannot reiterate enough, just like have a standard and be open and articulate it. And if somebody's like, look, I got no standards. If you want to inject something in yourself, just like go full send, go for it. It's like, hey man, like do that for yourself. I have a different standard. And so patients out there, I suppose, will end up seeking their advice from whichever type of person, communicator, whichever standards they feel kind of resonates more with them. People are allowed to take risks. They're allowed to do, you know, silly things, do stupid things. And so I think that having that standard be made clear is really a one way to cut through this a little bit.
You know, the standards were going higher previously until like the past couple of years. So again, in my world that you guys are all very familiar with diabetes, once upon a time, because it was, you know, it was kind of known as a blood sugar disease. Let's talk about type 2 diabetes, right? And so as medications were studied to improve blood sugar, that's how they got approved. And then one of our, you know, mentors from Cleveland Clinic, Steve Nissen, started noticing some issues with some of the blood sugar meds back in the early 2000s. And because of that, it turned out that some of them were causing worse overall outcomes. They were good for blood sugars, but potentially risky for the heart and increasing the risk of events that were bad for people. So because of that, the standard increased, meaning not only are diabetes meds needing to show benefits and safety for blood sugar and just short-term safety, but now they have to have huge trials showing long-term cardiovascular safety, which has also ultimately ended up showing which medications have cardiovascular benefits, like the SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists and others.
Yeah, I think it's also important to point out, like, this is not unique to like the general public, where their understanding of this, their hierarchy of evidence needs, it's not that it's significantly like worse than clinicians necessarily. Like, physicians, medical, like the medical industry has made these mistakes too, right? Like, this is all like, we are not absolved from making the same errors. I mean, you can, again, throughout the history, just, you know, people say, oh, well, this should do this thing, let's try it out. And then, you know, as the, again, floor for evidence has gone up and up and up, because we've identified the errors in our way, that has changed thinking. I just think it's, you know, it's not possible for physicians currently to know the risks and benefits of the majority of these unapproved peptide medications. And so it is very challenging then to have any sort of informed consent around these sort of things, saying like, here's what we should monitor, here's the expected effect, here are the expected risks, you know, interactions with other medications and so on and so forth for the majority of them. And so if a layperson was taking that in consideration, then they can make their own decision about that. And I think that's fine. That's what Austin was saying. Like, look, you can do what you want. You can take risks if you want. But I just don't want people to think like, yeah, there's a fundamentally sort of different understanding of these medications where your doctor knows way more about them than you do. There just not a lot is known, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you view it. If they failed in clinical trials to date, I don't know that it's worth knowing more about them other than like making that more well known. It's just the things have changed over the years, and you know, physicians make mistakes.
How about this logical fallacy? Creatine, protein powders, all these other things aren't FDA approved. What do you say to that? I know what you're going to say, but what would you say to that logical fallacy?
I mean, one, they aren't drugs. They aren't medications. So like, you know, there's a video. I just saw this reel. This guy, he's such a, can I curse on your podcast? There's,
sure. Yeah.
And please. This douchebag. It just, he's like as a person who has a high potential to be a douchebag, like I have good insight into this, like game recognized game. And so this guy, he's got his hair slicked back and he's getting into like a Cadillac Escalade or whatever. And hey, what do you say to people who are skeptical about peptides? He's like, I think you should that they're not FDA approved. And he goes, well, I think you should be concerned about that FDA approved McDonald's that you're feeding your fat ass or something like that. And I was like, okay, so food, you know, is regulated on many different levels by the FDA for, you know, contaminants, and they have a lot of surveillance around that. But it is fundamentally different than for drugs, which is good because they're different things. So when people are like, yeah, well, protein powder isn't FDA approved, I'm like, yep, because it's not a medication, right? And there's surveillance. The FDA is looking at like contaminants, like heavy metals, for example. That's why these reports come out. Creatine is a dietary supplement. There's post-market surveillance by the FDA, but because it is not a medication intended to treat, diagnose or otherwise provide some sort of therapeutic effect, it is not subjected to the same standards. If you're suggesting that medication should have lower standards, that is an argument. I'd be curious to hear the rationalization around that. And would you apply that to all therapeutics? Would you apply it to vaccines? Would you apply it to hypertensive medications, to cholesterol lowering stuff, to, you know, whatever? If so, at least that's logically consistent. But I suspect that is not the case, right? When people are like, FDA approval doesn't matter to me, I'm like, so you would take a medication to lower your blood pressure that's not FDA approved over one that is FDA approved? That seems unlikely.
Well, they do, because, you know, and I have patients, and I don't mind when they do this. They, you know, they'll do like, red yeast rice, which is a statin. And that's where we, you know, part of where we learn statins.
Yeah.
And it works. And there are data behind it. And have, talking about creatine has a ton of
trials. We also have trials.
Yeah.
You are
good trials, Mike.
Yeah. I think if there was another way by which you could study medications from like identification of the thing throughout its like R&D process to like launch it to the public marketplace in a way that kind of circumvented the FDA, we would be more open to like a non-FDA approved medication as a therapeutic that we widely recommended. But because in our country that is required for you to, like, you know, ethically prescribe lots of things and know, you know, that's just the process. We don't really have a way around that. We do have that for supplements. We do have that for foods and such. And so it's just, you know, that's what it is right now. Again, I don't think any of us are going to, like, protect the FDA and say they've never done anything wrong or anything silly. But suggesting that something that is not FDA approved is somehow safer than things that are FDA approved, that that kind of gets me a little hot under the collar. So,
yeah, I think contrarianism in general is just very popular. It's always been popular to an extent, but that accelerated big time in social media era, in pandemic era, in things like that, where trust in institutions was unfortunately, you know, like, squandered in many ways, and it's going to be tough to recover. To your earlier point about, like, how much do the stakes impact the decision? Because, you know, you said it's really difficult to have an informed consent process. And, you know, I think that that's partially true, in the sense that you could have a fully informed consent process where the information that you're providing the person is like, here's what we know about these peptides, almost nothing. Now, how would you like to take this, right? And so if somebody had a fully informed conversation where it was like, we don't know how this works, we don't know the purity of this thing that you're about to inject into your body, we don't know how effective it is in humans, now would you like to proceed? I think that, again, you might get a little bit less uptake. Some people, again, just because they maybe trust in anecdotes, or they have that contrarian tendency, and maybe because they feel fine and things like that, they might still be wanting to take it. But I can't help but transport myself, like, into the hospital setting, for example. Somebody's, like, acutely or critically ill, and I stroll in and I propose starting them on a medicine where it's like, so how would you feel if we started you on this medicine? I don't really know how it works. It's never been put into a human before. I have no evidence that it does anything. I really don't know what the side effects either. You ready to go? I think that, especially when those stakes are high, some people are like, are you even a doctor? What are you doing in here?
Yeah. But that's what
you're like, I have no idea.
What the responses on my post was like, oh, but the COVID vaccine's safe and effective, huh? And it's like, oh my God, you guys really don't know the difference between things that haven't been studied and had been studied.
None. No clue.
Yeah. It's a challenging thing. And you know, I'm taken back. I think I can say this now. You remember we all used UWorld to prep for boards, and like, if you discuss any of the questions, they would come after you. Well, look, we're all finished with that. And I'm sure this question isn't in the QBank anymore, but it was about a patient, and it was a vignette about him using anabolic steroids and having a clinical conversation. And effectively, they wanted you to say that he had anabolic induced hypogonadism, I think was the answer, something like that. But the whole explanation of the answer was that many patients who use these agents think that they know far more about this than their physician. So it creates an adversarial interaction. Now, it may be true, and particularly in that case, that they do, in fact, know more or have a better understanding of those agents. This is certainly the case here. People who are into the peptide space, right? You imagine them walk into your average family practice physician who may know peripherally that peptides are a thing because they see the same social media stuff that we do. But like, these are all still to them experimental agents. And so they're like, look, I got to know the current guideline updates on all of these different things. I've got a patient panel, thousands of people I got to, you know, keep in mind. I cannot commit to memory failed phase 1 and phase 2 clinical trials to the extent they exist, right? Whereas this other person is like, look, I'm creating AI generated peptide protocols and lists or whatever. And so I can't ask, you know, imagine they ask their doctor about MOTS-C. Mm-hmm. And the doctor's like, I've never even heard of it, man. I don't know. And they're like, see, doctors don't know anything about this. Yeah. That's why I am filling that role. And so I kind of empathize with people. Either if they ask their doctor, they feel like their doctor doesn't know. If you're in this space, health, wellness, optimization space, whatever, you kind of, their build is like these potential agents with a lot of upside. And then there's not really a lot to know about them. And so, and without the clinical training of like risk, benefit, informed consent, then it kind of, it just appears that there's mostly upside and not a lot of downside. And I think it's just very challenging to navigate. So I empathize with people both being advertised peptides, right? It's usually some very attractive or successful person. Look at what this did to me, right? That's been selling since the beginning of time. And then if you ask what you would consider a trained professional about these, they're like, shoulder shrug emoji. And so you compare that enthusiastic marketing, you know, with somebody who's like, I don't know, man. You can see why people are attracted to these things.
Yeah. Love it. Very good. Well, I don't know if there's anything else we need to talk about. One of the other drugs I was just thinking about is, if anybody remembers, the CETP inhibitors or CETP.
Yeah, that's a great example.
Inhibitors, for those who are listening, this is a drug mid-2000s, because I was in residency.
Not that long ago. They were still
I was in residency. The first one came out or was being studied, torsetrapid. Anyway, this is an enzyme. This CETP is an enzyme that basically exchanges lipoproteins, so cholesterol ester and triglycerides, between an HDL particle and LDL particle. Anyway, you can inhibit that enzyme, and what it does is it boosts up your HDL cholesterol, and everybody's like, let's crank up our HDL cholesterol because that's associated with fewer heart attacks. Well, the first one that they did that with, it killed more people, or it harmed way more people. Turned out, though, when they looked into it, it was increasing aldosterone. It was an offshoot. It had nothing to do with the CETP inhibition. So then they looked into it further with another drug called dalcetrapib. Did nothing. It wasn't harmful necessarily, but it didn't really help. They had a few more iterations of this, and finally they have one now that seems to work, but it has nothing to do with the HDL increasing. It had to do with the apolipoprotein B decreasing through, because it was a stronger drug that helped decrease apolipoprotein. It had nothing to do with HDL, and it's still not approved yet. But this concept of biological plausibility, let's increase our HDL because we kind of had a rudimentary understanding of it. But another thing that you just don't know, if you're injecting MOTC, all these things, people are like, oh, well, like, if it were harmful, we would see it in the anecdotes. If it were harmful, those people are dead. They can't respond on rhetoric.
Exactly.
I always wonder what the overlap is in the Venn diagram between people who are enthusiastically using these peptides and then people who, you know, go onto these social media platforms and they're like, I'm really curious to see what are the side effects going to be of these GLP-1 agonists in 20 years. And it's like, hey, guys, been at it for 20 years.
Yeah, 90%. I think a good conclusion is just talking about why these phased clinical trial processes exist. You know, so we have the preclinical, like you said, the petri dish. We have the animal studies before ever moving on to these small, you know, 20 to 80 healthy people phase 1 trials, just to test the pharmacokinetics and the pharmacodynamics, initial safety signals, and then it's, you know, phase 2 trials with several hundreds of people, and then phase 3 trials with thousands, because each phase really kind of serves as a gate, because so many drugs that seem promising in animals are eliminated like we just talked about, due to unexpected toxicity or lack of benefits or unfavorable, you know, other pharmacokinetics, et cetera. And sometimes it has to be after they were even approved.
Yeah. I have one. This is maybe a spicy take. Get your guys' feedback. I think perfect. This is like a perfect endpoint. So we've been talking about all these peptides. Again, most of them, not all of them, but most of them are not FDA approved, which means that you have to go through different channels to acquire them. Previously, you could get them compounded by compounding pharmacies, right? So we'll call it a more legitimate source than like research chemicals, which you are not required to be made in a, you know, a certified lab or a certified, you know, up to pharmaceutical standards, and they're billed for research use only. So there's a loophole that people can purchase them, acquire them without sort of prescription and the checks and balances around like making pharmaceuticals that humans have to take. Now, there's a study from JAMA where they looked at SARMs that were sold as research chemicals, so selective androgen receptor modulators that have been billed as like a better version of anabolic steroids because they're selective. Okay. Now, but in a research chemical form, they basically purchased all of them, sent them to a laboratory for chemical analysis using mass spec. Of 44 tested products, no active compound was detected in 9% of them. Substances not listed on the label were in 25% of them, and only 18 of the 44 products actually had what was supposed to be in there, right? And so if you think that you're getting these peptides from companies that sell research chemicals, and that it's probably what's on the label at the dosage, that's you know, that is an assumption that doesn't seem to bear out. So the spicy take, hot take.
That's amazing.
Of course. because a lot of these agents have been moved and currently reside for FDA's Category 2 list, basically says, look, you're a compounding pharmacy, you can't make them. That happened fall of 2023. And now with RFK Jr., some of them are likely to be taken off that list. And so compounding pharmacies can make them again. Is this a form of harm reduction where you think it's almost a better move to take them off the list where compounding pharmacies can't make them, pushing people to the research chemical market? And subsequently now, if compounding pharmacies can make them, perhaps there can be some observational trials done, even though those aren't the best. Do we think that's better? Or do you think they should stay on the Category 2 list and that people should be pushed to the research chemical?
I'll say there are two lines of thinking. Some people say we should just open the floodgates, let people do what they want to do. And you think about raw milk, for example. The issue with raw milk is that you can infect other people once you get infected with like Listeria. So like that's an argument against that. Can it harm
others? You just offended a lot of people.
Well, no, but seriously, raw milk, I understand like protecting because... If somebody else drinks raw milk and they can infect me, I'm like, screw you.
Yeah.
Well, should we just let people do whatever they want to do? I don't know. Are we big brother? I'm not sure. I don't have a good answer. I would hope some sort of protection.
That's but, that gets into political slippery slopes.
Well, I don't know. What do you think, Austin? You're a good harm reduction type of can you talk about it all? We talked about it on our lab podcast last time you're on here.
Yeah, I think that there's probably some form. One of the challenges regarding the clinical trial kind of pathway that Carl mentioned is it is a very high barrier for things, right? Mm-hmm. And yes, that's in some sense a good thing. It's like a sensitivity specificity sort of thing of like how far do you want to let things get before they get kind of weeded out, right? And there is so much cost and so much time. And if I want, I'm very reluctant to give the current administration a lot of credit on many things, but there's at least some thought about what modifications can we make to the whole like clinical trial pathway for like pharmaceutical approval? Are there some efficiencies to be gained there? Because, you know, it's not sustainable for like companies to need to put up $20 billion to bring a medicine to market. And to the extent that there is some potential, you know, plausible or biological benefit from some of these compounds, I think a lot of people would be interested to know that that was the case. And so my favored pathway would be something that involves basically as informed of consent as it can be. But like when these things are used, it should be like an auto default into some form of trial infrastructure where it is being studied in that way. I'm like quite comfortable with a lot of things that I do on a regular basis, recognizing that like what I'm doing is off label. And as long as I've had that conversation with the patient and they are okay with it, then I'm okay with proceeding and we know what we're looking out for and things like that, as long as there's some understanding of like known risks and unknown risks. I'm super comfortable doing that on a pretty regular basis. That would be the kind of thing that I would want to see happen if people are using these more often, is having that type of open conversation rather than it being like marketing, social media, hype, and contrarian driven, being like, here's a substance. There's maybe some idea that it might help your situation. We know very little about it. We'd like to try it. And while we're doing it, enroll you in this study so that we can very rapidly, because in that sort of way, we could gather a lot of information really quickly on these kind of things. And at minimum, you know, if to Jordan's point, if it's currently being used, a lot of it from this research world, where like maybe a fair amount of what people are getting, it's actually not even in what they're getting, then that means that most of the benefits, quote unquote, that they're experiencing are like placebo driven. To Jordan's point, I think this is somewhat the argument he's making, is like if it goes compounded and people are actually getting the thing with a little bit more reliability, then if there were harm that were happening, we would detect that signal more quickly. Mm-hmm. People do this with supplements all the time. I mean, we look for, you know, signals of harm and toxicity and like outbreaks of poisonings and things like that. And like the infrastructure is there to jump on those things pretty quickly. And so I think that, you know, you cannot protect everyone in society from all bad outcomes all the time. Like people are necessarily going to experience some harm in order for like society to progress. That is how this works. This happens with chemotherapy approvals. This happens with, you know, pretty much everything. There are people who... This is one side note, is like how many people's lives have been saved by being in the placebo group of randomized controlled trials over the decades, right? There are some people who benefit because they get to try high-risk drugs in high-risk situations and maybe it pans out. There are also a lot of people who survive because they were the lucky one in the placebo group who didn't get harmed. Further justification for like we should have some system, some infrastructure for like rapid data collection. There have to be more creative ways to do this compared with the very traditional, very rigid, very linear, multi, you know, decade long pathway, multi tens of billions of dollars pathway. And so maybe this is a way of, like, you know, establish something that links up each of these compounding pharmacies with some sort of trial infrastructure. And like, let's get these people looped in, rapidly collect some data. And you might have, you know, what was it called? Operation Warp Speed for the, you know, the immunizations in the past. You have like Operation Peptide Warp Speed. RFK can like lead the charge on that. Yeah. I'd be down with that. We'd gather the information as long as people are in agreement, there will be a standard that we are looking to meet in order to recommend these things. You're like almost pre-registering, like if it fails to meet this standard, then we're going to throw this in the trash and not recommend it anymore. That's going to be the hard part, is to get people to buy into that.
Perfect. The only other thing I'll last put out there is people think that we're poo-pooing these because we're not making money. I want to reiterate that Jordan and I were pretty good at business. Austin and my brother are both martyrs a little bit, but I don't think you guys understand how many millions of dollars we can make if we branded our own peptides.
Oh yeah,
and this is, you know, through our podcasts and email lists and social media, we could brand our own things and push this and really hype them up and say we're doctors, we lift, we got big muscles, we're strong, whatever, and these are making us recover, we're superheroes. Mm-hmm. I would probably use my brother's body over mine and start shilling this stuff and just million dollars. But we are trying to be ethical here. We're trying to follow science. We're trying to follow the standard. As Austin said, we have our basic standards. And this is why, from this podcast, why we explained why we do not recommend them unless we have strong data to support. So I'll leave it.
I realize how many millions of dollars I've lost out on over the past like 20 years since I graduated medical school.
Yeah.
by not, you know, giving in to quackery and standing by ethics and stuff.
Way to go. Good job having this group. Look at you. Anyway. All right. So if anybody's listening to this, wondering why we are kind of, say, bearish on some of these peptides, this is why. We love retatrutide, retatrutide, tomato, tomato. We love all these peptides that are coming out that have good data,
that work,
that have great effects. And so if you, anybody, friends, family, recommend this podcast to them. If you haven't already followed the Barbell Medicine Crew with Austin Brocky and Dr. Jordan Fagenbaum, go ahead and follow them now. We'll have the links in our podcast. Thanks everybody for listening.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.